In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Selling a little? Or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I double dare you to say that.
Of course I'll say that. Hold on. Adult man has wrist injury. Fuck off. Don't tell me he was riding a bike. Hello and welcome to what I'm told is the seventh instalment of our nerdy chat, which we still call Collecting Addicts. With me, Edward Lovett, Neil Clifford, Manish Pandey and Chris Cooper. Let's cut straight to the chase here. Neil Clifford has a problem with Japanese cars. He says, I quote, "I can't love them." Well, I don't know what to say, Neil, other than to give you the floor and tell us why you can't love Japanese cars.
Well, I've been deeply thinking about this, and you know what? It's my biggest automotive disappointment. I've tried so hard. You know, I've been reading these magazines from the 80s. I've been following religiously people's advice. I've bought the R32, which obviously I shouldn't have sold because they're now like £1 million, an R34, which I hated, an R35. I even bought the MX-5 Le Mans edition, you know, with the crazy paint and the turbocharger. I've had the Evo 6, which I also hated, that Mitsubishi thing. The S2000 because of the gearbox. My second car was my mum's 120Y Datsun before Nissan. So I buy them and then I look at them and then I get in a Porsche. And my conclusion, well, I think the Japanese know this. I've put a lot of thought to this, obviously, because it was the kickoff subject. I think the Japanese know that they're unemotive. And that's my conclusion, really. That's why they do Le Mans. It's why they do rallying. They've been told by McKinsey that they've got to put some passion into their brand. I didn't do a maths O level, but you know what? I think my conclusion
is... What's that got to do with love?
Just let me finish, okay. Chris. I think it's all about the 100% thing. It's really annoying, even in my job, that things have to add up to 100%. And think about this pie chart. There's this pie chart that exists, which is mechanical excellence and engineering brilliance. And then there's emotion and then there's passion. And basically, the Japanese have 100% of one and zero of another. It's like a pH scale. I can't remember the colours. Manish will be able to remember the colours, but Japanese is red, pH 1, and British cars, Bristol, are purple, a pH 14. And somewhere in the middle, there is the best cars, which is Ferrari and Porsche, because they manage to have both. They've got automotive engineering excellence, and then they've got emotion and passion. And the, frankly, a Japanese car is like having an inflatable friend.
I was about to say, you need a good wankle in your life.
You know, it's why the Swiss don't do fashion.
Right? I mean, how many constituencies and parts of the world have we offended, Daniel?
Well, look, I'm a global citizen. And I experience all these things. And it's why electric cars are doomed, because there's no emotion.
Discussed. Okay, I'm self-appointed gobshite on this group of people. I'm going to attempt to answer that, because there's a bit of it that I agree with. But what I think is missing, and my interpretation of it is different, is because I think sometimes objects, be they... they could be art, they could be food, they could be literature, sometimes require us to scrape a little bit below the surface to discover what might be underneath. And if they aren't just peacocks that immediately gratify and throw their emotion at us in quite a basic way, then maybe some people don't look hard enough. And I some of the examples you've given there are right at face value compared to their rival vehicles from particularly European and American countries, can look at times a little bit stolid, emotional, and dare we say, boring. But my experience is that the more I've spent time with them, they reveal a depth of character that can be really surprising. And furthermore, I think the more you get into your driving, the quirks, the engineering quirks that these Japanese car companies have given us, I find endlessly fascinating. Because to me, as a geek, the first time you experience the VTEC step, that's as profound as seeing a boat-tailed Alpha spider on the Amalfi Coast for me, because it affects me in the same way. The first time that you see the high-cast light flicker on an R32 Skyline is a moment for me. So I get the fact they don't lob themselves at you. What they are is they're that quiet girl or boy in the corner of the party that's not doing much until about 1 a.m. when everyone starts passing the good stuff round. And then they go freaking loopy on the whatever you've been drinking after 1 a.m. And they're going hammer and tongs at 7 a.m. And all your BMWs and Ferraris have gone to bed. I think when they do abject personality, they're nuts. Edward's dropped the W word, the rotary engines. Some of their engineering solutions are so unnecessarily complicated.
Yeah.
I can't believe what they do. And then there's Honda, and then there's Senna. There's a lot to it. I don't think I've persuaded you, Neil, but I still think there is real personality bursting from these cars, but they just don't know how to sell it. They're very poor at marketing their passion.
Does the Japanese version of Neil Clifford, who you probably know, Neil, somehow in your world of fashion,
Naito-san, the guy,
okay, does he have the same view of Japanese cars, or is what's his car in his garage?
They've got a 356. You follow them on Instagram, Naito.
Yeah.
They've got a 250 LM.
Yeah, they've got amazing cars.
They've got a 911R original, not the sort of chavvy new one. They've got a 911.
Cut to the chase. Is there a Japanese car in there?
No, there isn't, because it's a fucking washing machine.
But Chris, aren't you and Neil just slightly talking at odds? Because the premise was, Neil can't fall in love with this car. And you're telling me that you're going to fall in love with a wallflower that comes to light at 1 a.m. Because I think what he said, he's not arguing with anything that you've said. They're a bit repressed.
No, I do love them. I do fall in love with them. I had an Evo 6 for ages, and I really did love it. And there are some strange cars they've made. But I don't love them because they're obviously lovable. I find stuff, they grow on me. Then I can't get
this is proper Indian arranged marriage love, isn't it? That's what you're describing. Yeah. Right? There is just no chemistry at all, apparently. But your parents have made this high-level decision based on, you know, committees of whatever. And you know, 25 years into your marriage, you go, I can't live without this person. This is the best it could be.
And also, don't forget, I was at the back end of that generation. You used to have to write these big group tests for the car magazines. And they wrote themselves. You felt this massive pressure. The Italian be in the corner, as and so flamboyant. And then you'd have the German that would smash 0-60 faster than everyone else. And then the Japanese one would be there going, I just know I wouldn't put my money into that. Because I don't like the badge. And, they wrote themselves, those group tests. And I feel slightly ashamed that I bought into the stereotypes. So I can understand why they're not obviously things that you fall in love with. But maybe as someone who himself fits that category, I quite like engaging with the challenge.
Chris, it's taken us 7 weeks to get to this point, and I'm sure this is the producer's wonderful joke. They wanted to see five middle-aged men discussing what is love. And Chris, we're here.
Chris, you shared a video this week in our group chat of driving the M3 on a rally stage, probably in Wales somewhere. If you were to... an escort, apologies. Would you have a Japanese-derived rally car?
It's a terrible, terrible question. I'd have an AE86. It's the same thing. They basically copied the BDA and stuck it in a Toyota Corolla. It's one of the great, it's called the Hikiroku. It's one of the great Japanese cars. So yes, I would. But I think I get the point. But if it's room 101, quite often with Neil, I go, that's going straight in the bin. You're right, Neil. On this one, I'm sorry, it's not going, it can't go in the bin.
No.
Neil, good, straight question though. Datsun 240Z. Could you fall in love with that? Just
I've tried to fall. It's not as if I'm anti-Japanese cars. I've bought a load of them. I like any old shit, basically, with four wheels. But I think that there's a difference between owning and then getting in it on a Sunday morning. You're always going to choose the 911. And it's now worse for the Japanese cars, because in the 80s and 90s, it was the only car where wasn't going to break down, the air conditioning was going to be working. Now, Ferrari are reliable, Porsche are reliable. You haven't got to have like a PhD in science to figure out how to demiss the screen like in a 3.2 Carrera. So it's it's made more difficult for the Japanese to have a point of difference.
But when Subaru made the XT, which was that wedge-shaped thing, when you engaged the four-wheel drive system, the windscreen wipers came on because it assumed it was slippery. How can you not love that?
I think we're not going to persuade you. And I really like your opening speech. I mean, I completely guess it, but without getting into what is love.
Think about the pie chart. Bristol, which, you are guaranteed to fucking break down if you own a Bristol.
Yeah, but I think we learned a lot more about you, Neil, than about loving Japanese cars.
Maybe.
I've loved a Japanese car. I've talked about this before, my Mark 1 Toyota MR2. I love that. I nearly bought, it was my first company car, and I nearly...
What pronouns did you use with that?
I didn't use pronouns. I loved it. I didn't love her. Don't call cars, they're not gender specific cars, but you can love them, and I love my Mark 1 MR2, and I loved the CRX, the Gen 2 CRX. There was a Honda Accord, that Integra thing, all those sort of the early 90s and then early 2000s.
But given this is basically group therapy, can we agree as a group that we're going to work on Neil, we're going to help him with his problem, and we're going to find him something Japanese to love?
Look, I've just bought a Litchfield Impreza. I can't help myself, right? It's not as if I'm cured.
Now, moving on very quickly, because this is a subject we're going to come back to many, many times. What is the most disappointing car you've owned, Chris Cooper?
So, I technically didn't own it, but I sort of did. So we talked about electric vehicles. So when I had my electric vehicle, for a while, it wasn't working terribly well. So the dealer for about 3 months, 3 or 4 months, lent me a Macan, Porsche Macan. That was by far and easily the most disappointing car I'd ever had. It didn't do anything well. Its steering felt a bit rubber inelastic. It felt heavy. The engine was synthetic. It was just, these are first world problems, absolutely first world problems, but lots of people have Macans and aspire to them. I was shocked how disappointed I was by it. I had nothing nice to say about it. I tried a couple of versions, the turbo or not. I was really shocked how disappointing it was.
On a geek point, the current Macan is based on the previous Q5, isn't it? It's the old platform.
It felt like an average other manufacturer's middle market thing. It was really, really disappointing.
I've just received a small electric shock because I didn't think we're allowed to use the word platform on this podcast, are we? Sorry. Get with it.
It's lingo. They've all got it. But yeah, we can. I'm sorry.
Okay, Manish, you.
A little like Chris, I didn't actually own this, but my friend Dan, his father made a load of money in the mid-80s, and he bought himself a beautiful BMW 635 CSI, which was impeccable and stunning, and we loved it. But he bought his wife an MG Metro Turbo, and never have we seen a mismatch between big words that say turbo on the side of a car and sub 100 horsepower piece of dung.
Yeah, that would be.
The other thing is that they sort of advertise it, the kind of, you know, zippy, you get into this thing and, you know, Nigel Mansell would drive it sort of thing. And it spent all of its time. The mechanics just spent all of their time telling his mother, you know, they're not built for urban roads. It spent all of its time in the garage because the bloody turbo kept poking up. I mean, it was just dreadful car, dreadful interior. Looked, everything was wrong about this car.
Neil, I presume you've got one of those.
Probably.
Right, go on then, Neil.
Right, with this, I think I might be agreeing with Chris on this. By far, the most disappointing car I've owned is an E30 M3.
Oh, I almost wrote that.
Well, you've done me. You've got mine written down there.
You know what? It's all of that journalistic love of the balance of the chassis and the incredible steering and the sort of DTM heritage and the wider arches and all that. And I've owned three of the bloody things, including two Sport Evos. The engine is shit. It's gutless.
Yeah.
You're much better buying a 325i.
You're quite
right.
It's
a much better car than that E30 M3. Now, you can go on to E36 and M3s on from that, I think, are fabulous. But that car, you know, I bought one for 12 grand at George Wise Motors or whatever. I traded it in within 6 months for an Integrale, which actually is another one on my list that I was not particularly excited about either. I don't love four-cylinder cars. You know, why have a four-cylinder car? A four-cylinder car was when you pass your test. It's much better to have five cylinders or six cylinders or eight cylinders or ten.
Apart from if it's Japanese, look what the Japanese do with four-cylinder engines.
Or a racing engine.
Special.
I didn't know how obsessed you are with spreadsheets. Now this has been really. We should share.
I was just discussing it earlier at work about my love of Excel.
I think I'm with you on that. I've got two written down here. One was an M3 Sport Evo.
Mm.
I had the two M3s in my ownership that were considered to be the very finest of the breed and the very worst. So I had a fairly good condition black E30 M3 Sport Evo, and I had a very ratty Avis Blue 3-litre pre-twin Vanos E36 with the same twin rack, which everyone hated. And I tell you, it just made me realise that some of my predecessors might not have been at the top of their game. Because the E30, a 320D driven well would leave you for dead. You wouldn't see where it had gone. And you'd be sitting there wanking your own soup of talking about steering feel, but it meant absolutely bugger all as you watched the 320D disappear into the distance. And the E36 was a hoot, steered awfully, but it had a rampant engine with loads of torque, would do 150 all day long. And I didn't give a shit that it didn't have much steering feel because the rest of the car was magic.
Exactly.
So, yeah, totally agree with Neil Clifford. The other one I had written down, which is, I think was the biggest disappointment, was a bigger disappointment for me, was I had a 205 XS, my first ever slightly fast car when I was, it was Group 8 insurance, so I could get it insured. I was probably 20 or something, 19, 20 years old. And I saw a new 106 XSI for sale, done a few miles. And I thought, that's the car I want. I'm going to go from an XS to an XSI. I went from, They're both TU engine, that aluminium engine from Peugeot, Citroën as it was. I went from 85 horsepower to 100 horsepower, fuel injected, utter shitbox. It was flat, it was dead. I remember that awful moment, I've swapped the cars over. When you leave a car you think's amazing on a forecourt, you drive away and within seconds you go, what have I done here? And I drove back to say, can I swap it back? And the bloke went, no, nah, mate, I've been trying to get rid of that for weeks.
No, fuck, no.
Shambolic. But no, I'm so with you on that, on the E30.
Can I just say something in the E30's defense? I mean, again, this is a bit niche, and Chris, you and I have driven the same car I'm thinking of, because a friend of ours had the DTM E30 M3, the one that first won a DTM championship in 87, the Eric van der Poel car, and you and I have both driven it. And I drove it, I was amazingly fortunate to drive it in a race at the Nürburgring years and years ago. Nobody could have described that car as dull or boring. It had.
But this is the thing about these DTM.
I know. It's not. But it's amazing how different. You'd think the road car version of that should be quite special, and it wasn't.
No. If you put a grenade engine in the car, like my rally car, which is up on the lift just down the road here, has got 2.3 liters of probably 290, 300 horsepower.
Yeah, it's had 330 horsepower.
And they just, that's a different animal then, because then the chassis comes alive. The problem is it's got so much grip that the E30 doesn't really move around. Yeah. And I just, you're right, a 325i Sport, much more fun.
Oh, that's a wonderful engine, the 325. One of the best engines. Frankly, there aren't many good four-cylinder engines.
Ford that's, BDA.
That's on, a conversation all on
the VTEX.
Yeah. BDA, BDG.
Don't start with your BDs. Ed would love it. What's the most disappointing car that you didn't have to buy and that you crashed?
No, I was about to say, this is a terrible question to ask a car dealer. I'm not sure if the worst ones are the ones I made the biggest losses on. But an Alpina B5 must be up there, Chris.
Edward traded an Alpina B5 in probably 2004. I think it was there for a year.
It was the first supercharged B5, and I remember going to pick it up, and I pressed the throttle, and fuck me, this thing was quick, and I blew the supercharger, and then I think we had to wait about 6 months for parts, and then no one wanted it, so I'm not sure if I managed to get out of that without making a loss. But there's two cars I've written down here, and bear in mind, these are car dealer purchases. So I've bought them thinking, looking forward to having a drive in this. One of them's an Audi RS2 Avant.
Not good.
No, and they look cool, and the Porsche connection makes you think, I've got to have one of those. And this was the perfect car, UK supplied, green, but yeah, heavy, understeery. Really disappointing. And then the other car I bought, which was very cheap at the time, not at the same value as it was today, is a Ferrari 250 PF Coupe, which I think at the time it was still plenty of money, but I think I bought it for £120,000 or something like that. But I didn't fit in it. V12 engine, but with it, couldn't pull the skin off a rice pudding. You couldn't get your hands when you were steering; it would keep hitting your knees. And I didn't fit in the car. It was just so underwhelming. And how those got to £500,000 or £600,000 just blows my mind.
We will revisit this because I reckon this has just triggered me. I've got another 10 I suddenly want to talk about. I can see that in all of your eyes, but we'll save this goodness.
The journey to disappointment's a good one, though.
That word underwhelming that you just used is one of those, that's an awful word for a car enthusiast, because we demand so much from our time in the cars that it's not acceptable to be underwhelmed.
Yeah, I've got a list of more to go through.
I think Neil said this last week or the week before, but pretty much I'm probably the same as Neil, and I've decided in my head I'm going to buy something. I never drive it, and I think the best way to find out if I like this or not is owning one. And whether you take a loss or a profit afterwards, you've got to go through that journey of finding it, buying the perfect one that you think is going to be wonderful, and then the underwhelmingness sets in, and then the journey to selling it.
Collecting cars can help with both parts of that process, by the way. Just click on the link, and you'll find out next week maybe about my Integrale buying experience on collecting cars, because I'm only about 10 grand into making her work. And on Friday, I'm removing the head That's not what you do on a healthy car. Right. Next step. Manish, Dr. Manish, could you please talk us through Lawrence Stroll's wrist injury?
It is Lance's. I think
it's Lawrence Stroll.
Yes, Lance, sorry, yeah.
So apparently he fell off a bike, apparently in Spain, apparently not last Sunday, but the Sunday before. And what we know is he definitely didn't take part in testing a week later. And your wrist is a beautiful, complicated, wonderful thing. And the man who taught me everything about wrists was a wonderful surgeon called Mr. William Bodie, who is now retired. But basically, you've got two long bones, radius and ulna. You've got two rows of little wrist bones, and then you have these carpal bones. And so normally falling off a bike or something like that would give you a fracture through the very ends of the long bones. And much more uncommonly, you can crack one of the little bones. But if I had to bet money, and this is based purely on the fact that he's missed testing, he's gone to see a particular upper limb specialist in Spain, in Barcelona, and because there was a photo of him. And if you look very carefully at the photo, it's very subtle. His right sleeve is pulled right up to the knuckles, so just below the knuckles. So I think they're hiding a wrist splint. And if they're hiding a wrist splint, the other little subtle thing is the thumb in that photo is bent like this, not stuck out like this. If the thumb was stuck out like that, it would almost certainly be a scaphoid injury because you have a little extension that you put on. So if I had to guess what's happened is he's got either an undisplaced fracture of his radius, so he's cracked it, maybe not all the way through.
It's not sticking out.
It's not bent. And if basically you break them two ways. If you break them that way, you put them in plaster. If you break them that way, you put pins and plates in because they're unstable that way. Or he's whacked off this little bit here called the ulna styloid, but it's very subtle. I mean, the final thing, it could be a bunch of ligament injuries, but if I had to bet, I think he's got a very small undisplaced fracture and he's gone to see this man because they want to see whether it's worth putting a pin or a screw in to get him back faster. But
I lost the audio at the beginning of that, Manish. Sorry, did you say that this happened while he was masturbating? Because I didn't hear what you thought.
It was allegedly a cycling.
I've enjoyed doing this.
Oh, cycling, sorry.
Cycling accident. Well, look, the bottom line is, I just don't think we're going to see him back. If there's a fracture, 6 weeks.
Also might have just been very bad Tommy Hilfiger tailoring as well. You know, you might be looking into this a bit too much.
But the fact he wasn't testing is significant, isn't it? And also, I think we now realise with how compacted the Formula One season is and how little testing they get, that's a real back foot move, isn't it? You're struggling. If you don't get to do that first test, your teammate is ahead of you from the start. And if your teammate's already Alonso, this is just what we want. Camp Aston Martin, when Lance comes back, is going to be fantastic. Dad, I want a faster car than him. Little Spanish guy goes, he's not happening. And then it's going to be fireworks.
But isn't this good for Aston Martin? Isn't getting a better driver into that seat than him? Isn't that a positive? Isn't the fact that maybe his dad pushed him off his wheeler?
It's really interesting. You just think, I mean, he's not awful. I mean, he's doing better than we would do. It pains me to say. But he's not awful. But
he's a long way from awful. He is naffing quick on the right day in the right car. When they copied the Mercedes, when they had that Mercedes painted pink, that Checo won in, he was nothing quick. You don't get those results unless you're very quick in the car.
He was good. And actually, at this point, I want to say, some of you might have seen it, Andrew Green, who was, I think until literally a month ago, he was the technical director at Aston Martin and BWT and Jordan before that. I was in the same mechanical engineering class as him when he started doing it. I lasted one term. I wanted to be Andrew Green, but I realised after trying to help him with the colouring in bits of his stuff, it was beyond me. So thank you, Andrew Green. And he's done a brilliant job with that.
Alonso did a pretty good job in testing as well.
He did do a good job. I mean, he was third on long runs.
Alonso's talent's never been in doubt, but the results were interesting, weren't they? Let's have a little, think about the relative pace. We know that Red Bull and Max are out in front. We think Ferrari are in a comfortable second place. But third place, in terms of long-run pace, looks to be up for debate between Mercedes and someone they're selling engines to. So it's very, very interesting. And it's always great to have a cat in amongst those pigeons at the top, isn't it? It makes for good weekend racing.
You'd have kind of hoped that, and I know Mercedes stuck with their concept because they thought, do we take two steps back? I mean, none of us are engineers, although I came a small bit of help Andy Green with his covering in 20 or 30 odd years ago. None of us are in, so we don't really know. But it did seem interesting that they'd had a big do we, don't we? Do we carry on with the same concept or do we try and make something different work? And I was a bit disappointed. I just thought that machine, that Toto-led machine and all those people, you just think it just shows how hard it is because they're clearly brilliant and it just shows how hard it is. The one I'm most disappointed, I feel for, and I feel for Lando, we've talked about this amongst ourselves, is McLaren.
Because I
watched Drive to Survive when it came out last week. I still quite like Drive to Survive. A lot of it you can take, well, maybe next week we'll talk about that scene with all the team managers saying, you should change your fucking car. No, you should change it.
That was dreadfully embarrassing.
So I went back to watch the first series over the weekend. And there's a lot of it in there when Zach had been there not very long saying, well, the buck stops with me. You think, well, that was 5 years ago. And the buck still, they had that sort of very short-term bit where they got to third in 20. And they had that purple bit in 21, which then rapidly fell off before in 21. Ferrari overwhelmed them. You would think that Ferrari and McLaren 2 years ago, less than 2 years ago, were fighting for a third in the championship. I worry about McLaren, and poor Orlando, having signed that big deal, he must be really fed up.
I mean, have they ever done any good since Ron Dennis left?
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
They didn't do terribly well in the last couple of years of Ron Dennis either, though, did they? I think that the problem with that for me, that team started to drift terribly badly when Lewis left. If you just have a look, you know, there's a very, very simple line there. And I'm with Chris. I think rather than looking at the top of the sheets, which has a kind of predictability, I mean, the bottom line is even if the Aston is quicker right now, there is no way it's going to win a development war against Mercedes. I just don't believe that. So that's that. But the bottom end, if you are a McLaren fan, and I'm a massive McLaren fan, I know those guys, and I can just imagine how they felt when they looked at that. I mean, it was just slow, wasn't it? My gut feeling, though, is I think whatever direction they've taken, they're another very, very good team. You know, just a very good team. They're brilliant at strategy. They're brilliant at race weekends. And hopefully they will develop that car out of that position. But I mean, it's going to be awful seeing McLaren fighting Williams stroke. I mean, what else would you be? Haas, I guess, wouldn't you? As the bottom three. That's a really sad story, isn't it?
Yeah, they'll be on 4 years. So they've gone from third to fourth to fifth last year. Sixth looks like it's a stretch this year.
And where do we stand on the Piastri thing? Because we haven't discussed that. Do we think that there was some very sharp practice that doesn't reflect well on him with what happened with Renault? Or do we think it was just an absolutely fair dinkum contractual situation that that some clever management used to their advantage?
Well, probably he just wanted to, the best car to be in that he thought. And under the heading of contract shenanigans, I mean, all of this pales into insignificant compared to Schumacher and Spa in 92 and Eddie having one put over him by Tom Walkinshaw and Flavio.
And Bernie, I think you'll find.
Well, you tell us, man. You tell us.
No, yeah, but EJ still got that watch. He's still got that watch.
Well, absolutely. Somebody brilliantly. This was 1991, straight after Spa, and suddenly at the next Grand Prix, Schumacher goes from being a Jordan driver to becoming a Benetton driver. And Bernie just tells the story very well. He just said he had got a call from Luciano Benetton saying, my team's going down the tube. So the first thing he said was, right, get Flavio Briatore to manage it. He really liked Flav. The next thing they do is they get a damn decent driver in Schumacher. And he says Schumacher was up all night with him at the hotel. And Schumacher kept coming into the room. And eventually Bernie said, go to bed. And tomorrow morning when you wake up, you'll be a Benetton driver. And that's it. But I don't know if you've seen, there is a contract. Somebody put it on the internet. It's kind of handwritten. And they just crossed out things. They just literally just crossed them out, sign this. And you can imagine Eddie, you know, Bernie putting his arm around Eddie and saying, you know, sometimes you've got to lose a round.
But there's surely an element of schadenfreude here in that Piastri could well be in a vehicle that's going to be comprehensively outpaced by the Renault. And I don't know the ins and outs of that deal, but it didn't look nice to me. It didn't, it felt that they had adhered to the letter of the contract and maybe had been a bit sharp. And if they end up in a slower car, I mean...
Yeah. I think what Otmar was upset about is just supporting a junior driver, taking someone when they're a junior driver through the junior formulae. And yes, okay, you can turn around and say that they were, a little presumptuous, but I guess they had a right to be after quite a long time. And I think that's what sticks in all of our craws. It's not really a Schumacher situation. Mercedes paid for him to turn up at Spa and help Eddie out. But this is a situation where a young man was part of the Renault stroke Alpine setup for a while. And yes, I agree with you. There is an element of Chardon. There must be. If the Alpine turns out to be a cracking car this year, I can imagine Otmar having a little bit.
Yeah.
I
mean,
we all have to just care and wish luck to Lewis. You know, Lewis needs to win eight and then everything else is irrelevant in my opinion.
Yeah.
Well, at least you're consistent, Neil. And do you know what? Yeah. I agree. But I've got a funny feeling that if Lewis is going to win eight, it's going to happen in the second half of the season. It's not going to happen in the first half of the season. Right, moving on. We'll come back to that. There's going to be F1 chat every single week. Sorry about that in advance. How about this one, then? We're really going to cram a few in here. Best driving positions. Best driving positions. I think you can have one or two, but we can't go too far into it because, again, we're going to come back to this. This is going to be a recurring theme.
I think you need to lead this one, Chris.
No, Ed would love it first.
Well, it's got to be a 9/11, hasn't it? Does everything come back to 9/11?
Yes.
It does.
It does.
Well, it's got to be a 9/11. It's got to be some sort of bucket seat. I don't think you can have the best driving position and a comfort seat. And 991...
Basically, that's
GT3
right.
Touring.
Yes.
Yeah. In a seat's carbon upright. Bucket seat.
Seats too upright.
That's exactly you think,
Well, I like it. It suits me.
Exactly.
That's got a massive tick next to it, Edward. You get 9 out of 10 for that. Well done.
Thanks, boss.
Chris Cooper.
Not a 9/11 bucket seat. It's too upright. You need to have them sort of count back. I think it's K7. Because what makes a good driving position? To me, you want to be as flat as possible, legs out front, so you're not feeling having to lift your legs to get to the pedals. The steering wheel's got to be right here. For me, I know, Chris, you are the same. Don't tell you not. We want the steering wheel right here. It's not like that. It's like that. You know, the movies, that's not how you drive. The steering wheel's here. It's nicely at this position here. Your feet are out front. You're supported on your legs. For any kind of reasonable money, K from seven.
Well, that's a racing driver's answer, which is very unfair.
It's a road car. You could get on with another.
Long before I was a racing driver, I thought it made me feel like I was a racing driver, and that's a big part of it. Now, I think catering service, the bucket seats on 911s. I think we've all been conditioned to say, "Oh, it's like a racing driver's seat. It's a bucket seat. They're too upright. You have to sort of scooch down in them, so you're slouching an angle, and you've got no support." No, I think that's
nice use of the word scooch as well. We like
if
that.
If you get it all wrong in a Caterham on the road, how do you feel your recovery is?
Well, maybe you're describing your own driving talents, Edward, rather than ours. I've never got it all wrong.
That's fine. I get it wrong a lot, but I try quite hard to get
it
wrong.
There's not a lot of elbow room. That and the defender don't offer you many options in terms of elbow twirling.
Defender driving position is not good.
But do you think, Chris, when you're trying to answer what the best driving position is, it can't just be about how you sit. It's about when you're all over it. Have you got room to deal with the correction?
Yeah.
But it's more than that, isn't it? It's not just about, I think, as hopefully one of the rest of us will get into this, it's not just about how you sit, it's how you feel, it's what you see down the bonnet. You know, this is a multifaceted question. Neil Clifford.
On the basis I'm a shit driver, it's totally how I feel as opposed to what I do.
Okay.
Exactly the same as Ed, 991, 911R, I'd be flashy. When I get in that car, the fact that it's so low, that seat, and I'm quite tall, and you can pull it all the way back and then you move forward. That little move forward when you're tall enough, you're like, oh, there's so much leg room in this.
The sound, that runner.
And you flick it forward. And then the steering wheel does, you know, I've been taught, bring it forward to you. And then the leather, the quality of that leather on that steering wheel, and the R with those lovely old school dash dials, and then none of that haptic shit.
Yeah.
In all that new Ferrari thing, which is like Russell Hobbs fucking toaster. You've got proper buttons and proper switches, and the noise is amazing, and you're nice and low, and the leather's nice and soft. It's unbeatable, the 991 driving position.
Manish.
So I'm going grand touring here because I knew you guys would all race. And this is based on experience. I had to drive from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. I can't remember which year, it was mid, late 80s. And it was a Mercedes 560 SEC. Ooh, you're gonna drive in America on mostly straight roads for 4 hours. And they kind of go up and they kind of go down. You don't go too much. The driving position is unbelievable. You can see absolutely everything. The seat's so hard to comfortable, so your bum doesn't fall asleep. I didn't even stop the car. The air conditioning's amazing. You see all the dials. It was just the most perfect position, and it had a fantastically adjustable steering wheel, the seat.
That's essential.
I mean, you got totally comfortable in that car. The position was perfect. Every trucker was jealous on my way. It was perfect. 560 SEC.
I mean, it could be peak dashboard, that car.
Oh, really, absolutely.
You need to get into that for sure.
Right. Yeah. So that I'd have to say, team, you've excelled yourselves. So I don't know how I follow that. However, I have got one that in my early testing years, because I'm an odd shape, I'm a very, very short man with very, very short legs. I've got quite long arms. Italian cars sort of work for me. Everyone would moan about Italian driving positions, and I'd be thinking, why do they write about this being wrong? It fits me. I've got tiny legs. It works for me. But the first car that I drove that made me think, this, I can't complain about this driving position for anyone, was the E39 M5. Because I can remember getting it one. It had that heritage leather. And it was an electric seat that I pushed the down button. It kept going down. It went really low.
Yeah.
The seat squidged me in all the right places. I loved the clock faces. I then did that, dropped the old BMW lever down. The wheel came back to here. And I thought, even the wheel's in the right place.
Yeah.
And I remember driving one to Germany and back. And I didn't even know I'd been driving it. No aches or pains. That must be a great driving position.
Actually, I'm going to revise my answer, because that E39 5 Series, because there aren't many cars, dear listener, that will fit both Monkey and I, and we've tried to fit in some cars over the years together. that car is one. Even for me, we're just the seat just goes down and down and down.
I know.
I think, I want to bring it up a bit. I've never.
But to answer Edward's initial point, is that I've never driven a road car that comes even close to making me feel as good as I do in a well-fitted racing car. When you've had someone fit a racing seat to your body,
yeah,
one of the great privileges, forget ever having a suit fitted. When you've had the foam done to get in a single seater and you're there just prodding it around for an afternoon, it's an experience that you'll savor forever. And if you haven't done it, please try it. Now, moving on. This one is controversial, and I'm probably going to get shouted at here. I think, finally, in this country, because of the way the road network's working, the motorway network with our smart motorways, whatever that means, undertakings should be made legal, question, because it's becoming ridiculous. It's becoming ridiculous. In America, you can undertake. They drive the same cars as us. They have the same mirrors as us, but you can stick in a lane and undertake. I'm talking about swerving around being a fool, but you can carry on your journey on one lane whilst another car is stuck in another lane. I think we need to think about this being legal in the UK.
Well, in Europe, you don't need to undertake because they understand the etiquette of lane discipline, but in the UK, they simply don't.
Some is anyone going to agree with me, or do you think you're going to get cancelled?
No, I think you can't do it, Chris. I think it's too dangerous. I've been down a many a black hole on YouTube, and everyone crashes a Lamborghini Gallardo because of undertaking. It would be so fucking dangerous because it would take 30 years for people to respect the law. I think what we should have, so I have been thinking about this, legally, you should have a paintball machine gun strapped to the front of your car that you could actually just blast someone out of the middle lane, not damage the car. Just not, you know, not cause expenses for the other driver, but cover the back of their car in red paint in order to
know.
Move them out the way.
We all know it's there. Yeah,
that would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm for that. I'm word for word with you. I think it's kind of, you know, there are clearly you can undertake legally if you know motorway and respect so forth. But we know what you mean by undertaking, because why won't this person get away? I know I'm just going to give it some and we'll part. I think if that became the general rule, I think it unfortunately would be chaos. Although I do.
To be clear, I'm not talking about actually the point and squirt get out of the way. I'm talking about the fact that at the moment, if you're on a four lane variable speed limit motorway and a car decides to stay in lane four,
yeah,
technically you can be done for undertaking by just driving within the speed limit down lane three. You can be, that is still an offence. Even if it says stay in lane, I think it's actually at the discretion of the officer that stops you. And I'm saying, why can't you do that? You can't.
I think the logic, Chris, is correct. I think it would be better. It's just no one would.
Yeah,
it will go wrong is the issue, wouldn't it?
It will
go wrong in America. I mean, this is a country
because they're used to it because they're accustomed to it.
They go, first of all, they go at 55 miles an hour because they've done
all
this.
Some states 70.
Some states are 70, but I can tell you in California, 55 miles an hour, and they're all very, very close to each other. I mean, they are all literally, they drive like commuters. They don't drive to get anywhere quickly. Everybody wakes up going, right, this is my 2-hour journey. And that's what they do. And they sit in their lane and they just do this. I think driving here is very, very different. Very different. And I'm definitely with Neil on this. You can just imagine people looking over one shoulder and having to be completely retrained to look over two.
The fastest lane in California is the carpooling lane with one person in it. That's
exactly. An inflatable doll. Yes.
Well, there we go. I'll make more suggestions that my learning college totally disagree with.
You had a bad journey this week, Chris?
I've had a couple of bad ones this week.
Were they on the motorway?
No, actually, they weren't too bad. Although I had a sweet one this morning. I took the yellow car over to have some not gold wheels fitted to it. And I came back in my 129 500SL, which I haven't driven for a few months. And I got in it and it's just that pulse change. I've got out of my bright yellow look at me wagon to this anonymous old smoker. And I just cruised back. It's lovely. I felt no frustration whatsoever. But there was a tit on the outside of the M5 going south near Gordino. And he wouldn't get out the freaking way. And I just think to myself, what are you doing?
Well, that's the problem because you're near.
Is this psychologically? I think for everyone concerned, you're better off if you're stuck behind someone that's going the wrong speed in the out in lane three or four. You're not better off just dealing with it and just going up the inside and going past and sitting behind them, getting stressed, flashing, putting your indicator on, all the stuff we see people do. Just don't do it. Just go past them.
Yeah.
It's much better on a human level.
Tempting.
Well.
The problem tempting. Is you were near Gordano. See, if you were up near Gloucester, you could have gone into Gloucester Services and had yourself a pork pie and relaxed.
I could have done, but it would have cost me 37 quid. Instead, I went into Gordano and told them that Neil Clifford loves his KFC. Right, now then. I think we need to do our two car garage question, which this week was posed by Neil Clifford, but I'm going to read it out. The budget is £50,000. I know, a lot of money. This person, man or woman, has to buy two vintage cars for their early retirement for motoring enjoyment. One car has to come from the 1960s and one car from the 1980s. And they are all for pure two-seater driving pleasure. Okay? This is also, these cars are in addition to a family wagon or a practical car they already have. So these cars do not have to be practical. I am so pleased with my choices here. I'm going to start.
Go on.
Because I've smashed this out of the park. Watch this.
Yeah, okay.
First car. 944 S2 cab. What a great car. It's got a lowered top of the windscreen line, so it actually looks like a speedster. And any other Porsche with a lowered windscreen line you can't get one for less than 300 grand. These, 25 grand. They handle brilliantly. They look super cool. £25,000, I'm in. And they still feel quite modern to drive as well. They handle really, really well. I've not gone for the turbo because it's a bit complicated. You don't need the extra performance. I think for my second car, and this has got more than two seats, but it is a convertible. I think I've got the speed thing lit there. I want some Americana. I want my elbow on a door, but I've got 20 grand, 25 grand left if I'm lucky. But a little Dodge Dart from the 60s, convertible.
Yeah.
Throw the hood back with a small V8 in it. What a joyous thing to just roll around in. Anyone that spent a summer listening to the burble of a V8 with bits of vinyl and clips falling off it and everything else, I think I have smashed it out of the park. I'm going to get myself a cup of tea because I've won this.
That's quite good. Yeah, I'm the only reason I didn't mention the 944 convertible is I forgot about it.
Or did you spend your money on a Daimler Dart? Because I know you've got a penchant for a Daimler Dart.
What a gopping
an ugly car. No.
That looks like the Silver Hornet from Clouseau films.
You're gonna laugh at this. '80s car, BMW Z1.
Oh,
I know they're awful. What? I know they're awful.
No, they're keep breaking the budget. You spent all your money.
You've got 10 of the other car.
25, 35 grand collecting cars.
No, they're not. They're 40.
No, they're not. Not on collecting cars.
What didn't Matthew give us one? What did we sell that one for?
I think that was 45 grand. Well, it's all right. He might come up trumps with his 5 grand.
I'll show you. We can put it on. The producers can put it on the screen. We'll find it.
Oh, no. Mr. Cooper, I've got your solution. Yours was Cat S.
If it was a good one, 175,000 kilometers.
It's my choice. 60s car.
Yep.
Frog Eyed Sprite with a Swift Tune engine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's not bad. Yeah. Do you fit in one of those?
Yeah. Easy. Yes, I've got a Swift Tune Mini. I fit in that really, really easy.
And the Swift Tune engine takes up all of your budget. So what are you doing with the rest of it?
So that's it. I reckon you could get a Frog Eyed Sprite with a Swift Tune engine if you did a deal with Mr. Swift.
Mates rates.
About 15K.
Okay. That would be a great car. That would be a great car.
Yeah.
I like that. Okay, Neil.
Okay. Thinking Man's 275 Ferrari is an Alfa GT step front. My 50 grand is actually, I'm spending it in about 2015, to be honest, but anyway. So a little Alfa GT, aluminium, 5-speed, all-round disc brakes. For a 4-cylinder engine, good noise, super light. So I've just spent a week driving one around Sicily in October.
How much are you spending on this car?
Let me look at my other car. I would get that for 35 grand.
Yeah.
Get that for 35 grand in a lovely dark red with tan leather. And then I would buy a Golf GTI Campaign Mark 1. in black with the stripy cloth and the golf ball gear knob.
Pirelli wheels or not?
Yeah, the campaign only had the Pirellis. And the little windy sunroof, that'd be 15 grand. Perfect. 80s, 60s, wrapped up. Beautiful.
I tell you what, that's a lovely pairing, and you've spent your 90,000 well. Manage.
I am going to buy a 1989, just sneak it in, Chevrolet Corvette. The ZR1, and I'm going to spend £32,000 on it. And it's, I think it's the same horsepower as a Countach, 375 horsepower, had that amazing gearbox, 6-speed gearbox, really, really quick car.
I've just been reading that, Manish. I've just been reading that before you came on air.
So I haven't, but I'll tell you one little thing it had. It had a very special key. Do you remember it had this thing called the valet key? So if you put it in and you turned it, the whole idea was that you could lend it to your kids or get the thing back because it switched 150 horsepower off.
They call it the Edward key.
The Lovett key. So with my 18,000 remaining pounds, I'm going to buy a Mini Cooper John Cooper conversion.
Yeah.
Completely. £18,000, British Racing Green. Two white stripes, black leather interior with white piping, walnut fascia. They are my cars.
Great. Okay, I can't fault those. That's a brilliant... The ZR1.
ZR1.
Come out of nowhere.
ZR1. Isn't that 280s cars you just bought, though?
No. The Cooper Syngent conversion, what was that? 69, I thought, wasn't it?
Neil, that's quite punchy coming from the man that spent £130,000 in Yeah. Ed would love it.
Neil's stolen his from me. So I think, and actually, it's funny when you go and start thinking 50 grand's not a lot of money, but actually, not a lot of money in some of the cars we talk about. But you can buy an amazing array of cars. So an Alpha 1750, pimped up by Alphaholics, and I'll, as some of my shares come to value, I'll probably get some different wheels done, and I'll keep spending money on it. So an Alpha 1750, beautiful looking car, and if you see one of those Alphaholics cars sliding around, which Chris, you've done a cool video on one of those, they're just wicked things. And then I need to be able to get the roof off on something. So not the best engine, but I think I'd probably need a gold 280 SL in my life or something like that.
Yes.
I like it.
Yeah.
As in one from the 80s?
Yeah, an 80s 280 SL.
You're talking about a Bobby Ewing here?
Yeah.
Yes, love
golf
it.
Clubs in the back.
That is by far and away our best effort. Everyone has knocked it out of the park there, because normally there's a weak link. Normally it's me. But I think that's a great collection. So to end this week's adventure, we'll contribute one song to our ever-growing playlist on Spotify, which is called, Edward, what's it called?
I think it's called Collecting Addicts Driving Tunes.
There you go. Ooh. I'm going to start by suggesting that to just support my learned colleague, Neil Clifford's emotional outpouring at the beginning of this, that I think I'm going to go for What Is Love by Hadaway.
Shall I go next?
Yes.
I'm trying to be modern because otherwise we don't want to be in this sort of stereotypical old fart 50-year-old people.
Don't talk about Manish's music choices like that, Neil.
I'm going London Grammar.
Yeah.
Oh.
And Californian Soil. Stick that on. It's beautiful. Beautiful.
Good shout. Very good tune, that. Chris Cooper?
So yesterday, I spent a morning at Silverstone volunteering to help with the Mission Motorsport track day, driving Keep You Around, which is great fun. Really, really uplifting every way. And I'm just on the radio on the way home. Lovely Day by Bill Withers. And it just made the day. So Lovely Day, Bill Withers.
Great tune. Which advert? Was it a Ford advert or was it?
No, it wasn't an advert. It was just there on the radio.
No, but back in the 80s when it was used, was it Ford or was it Vauxhall?
God, it's a good call. We'll come back to
this week. I think it was Ford.
I mean, at some point we need to talk about bloody Vauxhall.
We do.
Yeah.
Manish.
Japan, Quiet Life. I'm sorry, old song, but that is the song to hear when you get into a car.
David Sylvian. Yep.
1080s track that.
Yeah,
absolutely. Region.
Yeah.
And EFL, what is it going to be?
I'm gonna follow your theme of love, Chris, and I'm enjoying this because I don't normally listen to music. I listen to podcasts when I'm in the car, but I'm getting back into music. And Neil's right to try and keep it a bit young where possible, and we'll keep fettling the list so we get the optimum driving list. But I've gone for Kiss. I Was Made for Loving You.
Okay, we'll end it this week there. Thank you very much to Chris Cooper, Manish Pandey, Neil Clifford and Edward Lovett. Tune in next week for what I hope will be episode 8 of the Collecting Addicts podcast.
See you later.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.